Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio guided walk featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long forgotten murders, all set within and beyond the West End. Today's episode is a romantic wartime tale about Barbara Shuttleworth and Felix Sturber, who, amidst the ruins of a bombed out London, found comfort in each other's arms. And yet, something led these two lovers to end their lives in a truly bizarre death pact. Well, sort of. Murder Mile is researched using the original police files. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details, and is a dramatization of the real events. It may also feature loud and realistic sounds, so that no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael. I am your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 86, The Lover's Death Pact. Today, I'm standing on Queensway in Bayswater, W2. One street south of the drive-run jewellery heist for the Charlotte Street robbery. Three streets north of the Blackout Ripper's final victim, Doris June. A short walk north of the site of the Hyde Park bombing. And a little dawdle from the little-known truth of the memorial to the murdered policeman, Jack Avery. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Queensway is a bit of a dog's dinner. Being uncomfortably wedged between the piss-poor gloom of Paddington and the pretentious arseholery of Notting Hill, this side of Bayswater is a mess. But as a mix of wealth and culture, what you can buy for 99p at Akmal's Discount Cash and Carry is also flogged off for five times the price at Susie's Splendiferous Yummy Mummy Parlour, where the thickest shit wives of wealthy stockbrokers are duped into buying utter crap like vegan bikes, veggie wigs, meat-free meat, leopard print pants for the lactose intolerant, ethically sourced air for the gluten-free, and everyone's favourite con, beaded prayer mats, rebranded as authentic ethnic yoga mats, as used by Madonna when she made some mumbo-jumbo religious twaddle fashionable for six whole seconds. On the corner of Porchester Road, at 210A Queensway, is Ralph Court. An impressive, eight-storey red and brown-bricked mansion covering half a square block. But with no access, except by locked doors and a glaring concierge, through the black wrought-iron gates, there to keep the riffraff out, it looks like a nice place to live. And although, in its central courtyard, some residents sit and lose themselves in a tawdry tale, they're unaware that just yards away was spun a truly strange tale of love, death, and suicide. As it was here, on Friday the 30th of July 1948, that two lovers entered a strange suicide pact, where both of them would die, but only one of them knew why. But Barbara wasn't looking for love. She was looking for the one. In autumn 1922, Barbara Sylvia Shuttleworth was born in the quaint market town of Knaresborough, 4 miles east of Harrogate, and nestled amidst the breathtaking scenery of the Yorkshire Dales. Her upbringing was idyllic, as happily playing with her pals amidst the vivid hues of the moorland moss, the lush green valleys, and the crystal clear lakes. Far from the choking smog of the city, her childhood was untroubled. As the only child of John, a retired captain and affluent stockbroker, and Gwendolyn, the granddaughter of Sir Roland Baron, a pioneer in the manufacture of ready-to-wear clothing. Although the Shuttleworths were well off, they weren't the idle rich, but came from a heritage of the industrious working classes who prospered. And whilst many good persons struggled to survive in the austere shadow of the First World War, John and Gwendolyn Shuttleworth ensured that their daughter had it all. She had health, wealth, and happiness. Privately educated at the same finishing school as her mother, tutored in etiquette, deportment, and social grace, Barbara was raised to be a lady who was polite, moral, and charming. An immaculately dressed woman with brown permed hair, an illuminating smile, and a towering elegant stance. But a finishing school is not a university. And although she was also taught history and English, living in an era where a woman's role was to look pretty and stay quiet, their misguided belief was that if a lady spoke proper, stood upright, and had a smattering of brains to make small talk with a potential suitor, she would find herself a good man, and she would live a good and full life as his wife. It was an old-fashioned notion that led Barbara's parents to wed and subsequently divorce. By the outbreak of World War II, as an avid reader of history and poetry, 17-year-old Barbara had found her true passion in the London libraries. By the middle of the war, like most people, the barrage of bombs had become just an annoyance to this independent woman who sought a career, and maybe if she had time, a man. By 1946, still single, but sifting a slew of suitable suitors, who, regardless of their age, title or wealth, had to be someone that she actually loved. When the bombed bits of the House of Commons were rebuilt, the British government established a very modern research department in the Palace of Westminster and hired Barbara as its assistant librarian. Barbara Shuttleworth was a well-balanced woman with a good career, a busy social life, a happy home life, and raised to be polite, moral and decent, she had her pick of the men who fell at her feet. One possible suitor was Lieutenant Colonel Felix Sturber, and he would love Barbara to death. Although a military man, Felix was a man of his emotions. Felix Jan Sturber was born in 1897. His early life, just like Barbara's, was idyllic. Home was a beautiful little farm at the foothills of the Tatra Mountains in the far south of Poland. So peaceful and tranquil was this tiny village that even before a rickety funicular railway turned Zakopane into a popular ski resort. With its crisp fresh air, icy cold lakes, and snow-capped peaks, it was famed as a health spa. As the youngest boy to 3 older sisters, and the only son to a doting housewife mother who spoiled him rotten, and a stern, overbearing father who scared him, like most children, Felix was the product of both parents. He was sensitive and thoughtful like his mama, but intense and precise like his papa. So as a physically tough, but emotionally fragile little boy. Burdened by a big heart and an overactive brain, he had a desire to be loved and a need to control. On the 30th of November 1929, 31-year-old Felix married a pretty local girl called Maria. Believing she was better than he actually deserved, to keep his wife happy, he built her a stunning timber cabin called Villa Silanca in the Tatra Mountains. As a meticulous man, he crafted a solid career as a pilot in the Polish Air Force, ensuring that she was never without. Desperate to be a dad, on the 19th of July 1931, they gave birth to a little boy called Andrea, a date he immortalized on a gold medallion which he always wore around his neck. And although he was cursed by a jealous streak and paranoid that his modest and faithful wife would leave him, he signified his undying love for his beloved Maria by inscribing her name and wedding date inside his gold ring and secreting a photo and a lock of her hair in a gold locket.
In which all Europe may find peace.
On the 30th of September 1938, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain held aloft a sworn statement from German Chancellor Adolf Hitler, in which he assured the people of Europe that there would be peace in her time.
Never to go to war with one another again.
But it was all a lie. On the 1st of September 1939, Germany invaded West Poland. By week two, war was declared. By week three, the Soviets had invaded East Poland. And by week four, with 70% of all Polish aircraft either destroyed or confiscated, and with the country left defenseless, Poland had fallen, and its people were under both Nazi and Soviet rule. With the Polish Air Force obliterated, 43-year-old Lieutenant Colonel Felix Sturber and the remaining pilots were forced to flee. By October 1939, he was in Romania. By December, he was in France. And knowing that his wife and child would be safe in their remote mountain retreat, like most people, believing that this whole hullabaloo would blow over by the end of the year, he wasn't unduly worried. But as the Germans drove west, the Allies were evacuated from Dunkirk, and the Nazis paraded through the streets of Paris, with the enemy perched just 100 miles from the coast. On the 30th of June 1940, Felix fled to England. He hadn't seen his family in a year. Every day away was torture. Every mile apart was like a stab in the heart. And although, as a prolific letter writer, the few letters which got through from his loving wife reassured her paranoid husband that they were alive, well, and that she would remain forever faithful, as a tough military man who struggled to rein in his emotions, the only time he could be near his family was when he held his golden locket, medallion, and wedding band. He was alone, lonely, and broken. 2 years later, as the war raged on, Felix was still stuck in England. And then, he met Barbara. As an Air Force veteran, Lieutenant Colonel Sturber was snapped up by the British to train a new fleet of fighter pilots based out of Regent's Park. With only wooden mock-ups for dry runs, the training was mostly theory. But with the average rookie pilot's lifespan being just 16 minutes, time was short, turnover was high, and as a rough, no-nonsense officer, Felix demanded perfection. But the war effort was just a distraction from the pain of missing his family, and when he was alone, he would become depressed. For Felix, as he shuffled through London's West End, all he saw was dirt, dust, and death. After 4 years without his family, food tasted bland, time had no meaning, and he drank to forget. Every day it rained. And then the clouds parted, the sky turned blue, and the sunlight shone. On the 14th of June 1943, while supping a cup of tea at the Lion's Corner House Tea Room in Marble Arch, Felix met 21-year-old Barbara Shuttleworth. She was bright, charming, and beautiful. A breath of fresh air with a beaming smile, who effortlessly breezed through the drab grey ruins of the bombed-out city. And as he became dizzy from the joyous sound of her songs and the sweet scent of her perfume, in a world so full of pain, chaos, and horror, suddenly the dead weight in his heart melted away. That night, in his diary, Felix wrote, "Met Basia," the Polish word for Barbara. For Felix, she was a lovely girl who eased his pain, made him smile, and shared his love of poetry. For Barbara, although she was a singleton with many suitors, as he was a decorated war hero, a sensitive gentleman, and a generous friend, he was a real catch for some lucky lady. And she was interested. Briefly, as happens during wartime, a little bit of innocent flirtation blossomed into a romantic dalliance. But as she was half his age, and he was a happily married man, it was never meant to be. So knowing that once these hostilities were over, and that he would return home to his wife and child, they would simply remain as just good friends.
Hostilities will end. Today is Victory in Europe Day. Long live the cause of freedom. God save the king.
On the 2nd of September 1945, with Hitler dead and the Nazis defeated, as a 100,000-strong crowd of excitable people erupted in jubilant celebration across Trafalgar Square, just like many others, Barbara and Felix kissed and cheered, as after 6 long years of fear and separation, the war was finally over. But as the street parties died down, for many allies, a new war had only just begun. With Germany split, and a supposedly peaceful Europe being sliced up between the democratic West and the communist East, Poland was placed under Soviet control. Having fought against a Nazi dictatorship and died to defend this country, the Polish forces rightfully felt cheated, as they were forced to exchange one brutal regime for another. Like many Polish troops, for now, Felix was stuck. He was a soldier with no war to fight, a pilot with no plane to fly, a father with no child to raise, and a husband with no wife to love. He had nothing. For Barbara, the end of the war meant business as usual. With her lovely floral townhouse untouched by the Blitz, she still lived with her mother at 35 Bark Place in Bayswater and often saw her father in Knightsbridge. With the government busy, she had been promoted to senior assistant librarian in the Palace of Westminster. And having waded through a slew of potential suitors, her love life had blossomed, having got herself a boyfriend. He was charming, he was kind, and he was sweet. But he wasn't Felix. In his eyes, Barbara was his lover. In her eyes, Felix was her friend. And with their brief flirtation having come to an end 5 years ago, as much as Barbara had tried to distance herself from Felix, as a lady who was raised to be moral, charming, and polite, it was hard for her to sever all of the ties with a sweet man who was so broken. She had to end it. But how? At home, she'd be sent his letters. At work, she'd get his gifts. Outside her window, she'd see his face. And every night, sometimes twice, she'd hear his phone calls. He was a married man who was double her age, and she didn't love him. So as much as it hurt her, Barbara broke off all contact with Felix, hoping that silence would cause him to forget all about her. Only it didn't. In late 1947, paranoid that his wife was being unfaithful, and ironically, seeing her as his only obstacle to being with his one true love, Felix applied for divorce, informed Barbara by letter, but got no reply. In Christmas 1947, he made two gold medallions, inscribed with FS for Felix Sturber, BS for Barbara Shuttleworth, and on the back he wrote London. His he hung around his neck, but hers was never found. And as 8 months passed in silence, being sat in his lonely little bedsit on the seventh floor of Ralph Court, he filled his diary with nothing about his life, just his many failed attempts to contact Barbara. Sunday the 18th of July 1948, the diary read,
"Phoned Bathsia."
Monday the 19th,
"Was in Bathsia's home. Was wonderful."
Tuesday the 20th,
"Phoned Bathsia."
And yes, she had made contact and let him in, as she had something important she needed to say. She just didn't know how to say it without breaking his heart. Wednesday the 21st,
"Phoned Bathsia."
Thursday the 22nd,
"Bathsia didn't turn up. Mother ill."
Friday the 23rd,
"Bathsia didn't phone."
Saturday the 24th,
"Bathsia didn't phone."
Sunday the 25th,
"Bathsia didn't phone."
Monday the 26th,
"Bathsia didn't phone at 10 p.m. I was under her window."
And Tuesday the 27th,
"No news from Bathsia. Is it the end with us? I phoned and asked her if she is alive. I have to speak with her."
That day, she had to speak to him before he saw what her mother had prematurely placed in The Guardian, The Times, and the Yorkshire Post newspapers. It read,
"The engagement is announced between Michael Thomas Lupton, the only son of Mrs. D.W. Lupton of Chester Row in Belgravia, and Barbara, the only daughter of John and Gwendolyn Shuttleworth."
Felix didn't see it. But still, she needed to tell him this to his face. As being raised proper, she knew it was the decent thing to do. Wednesday the 28th.
"Phone Bathsia. I think we will meet."
And although her call was only brief, it buoyed his spirits. As on Thursday the 29th, he wrote,
"Bathsia promises. Said she would come tomorrow at 1 p.m.
But at that very point, Barbara had other things on her mind. That evening, over a romantic candlelit dinner in a lovely little bistro in Bayswater, a besotted Barbara clinked champagne flutes with her fiancé Thomas. It was a glimpse at their happy life ahead. And to everyone who saw them, they were very much in love. After a 2-year courtship, they were engaged, soon to be married, and with the purchase of a little flat in Highgate almost complete, Thomas slid his lover the key to their first home together. And as she left, in Thomas's own words, he said that she was absolutely ecstatic. But Felix had made his decision. His last diary entry on Friday the 30th of July 1948 simply read,
"Bathsia will come at 1 p.m. God knows how it will be. Perhaps we will perish. The end of the chapter for you and me."
For Miss Barbara Shuttleworth, the soon-to-be Mrs. Barbara Lupton, Friday the 30th of July 1948 was a day like no other. It started pretty ordinary. At 7 a.m. she awoke, washed,
dressed and ate an apple. At 8 a.m., elegantly dressed in a blue and white cotton dress, a black hat and black shoes, she left home with a spring in her step, hopped on the Bayswater tube to Westminster, and by Big Ben, sashayed through the stiff suits on Parliament Street, and breezed into number 1, Derby Gate. As a librarian at the House of Commons, Barbara was like a ray of light in a grey room of gloom. But even more than usual, her colleague, Pauline Bebbington, said that she seemed joyous, but also nervous. Today was a big day. At 4:30 p.m., with a key, a tape measure, and her mother Gwendolyn, she would head to 29 Highgate West Hill in Hampstead and decide on the furniture and fittings of her new home. But first, she needed to set the record straight. At exactly 12:45 p.m., with only a 1 hour break, a 30-minute journey to make, and no time to dither, needing to be back at work by 1 p.m. at the latest, she packed up, dashed out, apologised to Pauline for missing their lunch date,
sorry, sweetie. There's to be Monday, okay?
And caught a taxi to Queensway. Arriving at Ralph Court, just shy of 1:15 p.m., she exchanged a pound to pay the taxi with Charles Haddon, the porter, took the lift up to the 7th floor, and with the red-bricked mansion block being U-shaped around the floral courtyard, at the far end of the corridor, she rang the doorbell to flat 147. As a three-bedroom flat, owned by landlady Margaret Rydell, who was out, she was greeted by lodger Mira Milosevic, who was just leaving. And as Felix, who had taken a sleeping pill the night before, still wasn't awake, Barbara was let in, left alone, and there are no witnesses to what happened next. At 1:45 p.m, the cleaner, Beatrice Benham, arrived. She heard no sounds, she saw no people, and assuming that the flat was empty, she started cleaning the kitchen. 10 minutes later, the courtyard filled with screams. The flat buzzed with panicked people. The porter tried to bash down the bedroom door. And with the police called at 2:03 p.m, they arrived by 2:07. But it was too late. Felix's bedroom was a small bed sitting room with a single bed, a desk, an armchair, a wireless radio, and a small balcony window overlooking the courtyard. Being a meticulous military man, it was smart, neat, and sparse. But with every item listed on a very precise inventory, as if he was planning to leave. On a rail hung his uniform, all pressed and starched. On his desk were his medals, his family photos, a wedding ring, a gold locket, and 2 gold medallions. On his bedside table was a glass of water, a pot of sleeping pills, his diary, a book of Polish poetry, an unopened letter to Barbara, a sealed letter to his son, the inventory of all his worldly possessions, and his last will and testament. On the floor was a gun. Felix was missing. And lying on the bed was Barbara. According to the police investigation, this is what happened. Felix had made a decision. As he and Barbara were lovers, either they would live together, die together, or if he couldn't have her, then no one could. But having had a fitful night's sleep and taken a sleeping pill, he had overslept. So although he dreamed of looking resplendent on his last day alive, dressed in his crisp uniform, shiny boots, and gleaming array of medals, as Barbara knocked on his bedroom door, he was dozy, tired, and wearing just his pajama bottoms. At 1:55 p.m., Barbara was sitting on the bed. Felix was standing by the door, and from his desk, he pulled a revolver. There were no screams, just three quick shots, then a fourth and a fifth. With the gun muzzle flush to her hairline, firing at point-blank range, which flashed black powder burns between her left ear and eye, the first shot ripped through her left temple, eviscerated her left and right temporal lobe, and shattered the right temple, causing extensive hemorrhaging to her brain. Almost immediately, Felix fired a second shot. With Barbara still sitting upright but slumping forwards, a bullet smashed her third rib, pierced her left lung, and the seventh rib of her back, leaving a deep red stain on her blue and white dress, just above her heart. With her left lung having collapsed, her chest cavity filled, and she began to drown in her own blood. The third shot came within a second of the last. But this wasn't for her, this was for him. With his suicide pact almost complete, he placed the gun into his gaping mouth, the barrel flat against his palate, and with the muzzle pointing towards his brain. Felix fired. The right of his skull erupted in a thick red mist, and with a heavy thud, he slumped to the floor. But he wasn't dead. Somehow he had survived. Picking up the gun, into his mouth, he fired it again. But still he didn't die. Why? He didn't know. He had felt the hot fiery flash in his mouth. He could taste the acrid cordite on his tongue. And up his wall, down his heaving chest, onto his trembling hands, and soaking his pajama bottoms was his blood. But still he was breathing, and still he was alive. He fired a fifth shot, this time into his heart. Only he missed and hit his left arm. With the gun being a six-shooter, he knew he would only have one shot left, one chance to end it all. So desperate to die and to be with Barbara, he put the muzzle of the gun flush to his temple and fired. Only it was empty. There was no sixth bullet, and he had only one option left. At 1:55 p.m, having snuck up to the roof for a cheeky cigarette, Charles Haddon, the porter, heard several shots in quick succession.
I then saw Mr. Sturber at his bedroom window, stood on the sill, half naked and looking down. He hesitated for a second, sank down onto his haunches like he was crouched, and then he rolled off.
Felix plunged seven floors, roughly 70 feet, and landed hard. His upper body smashed onto a brick wall, and his lower body hit the concrete slabs 1 foot below. But miraculously, again, he didn't die. At least not there, and not yet. The ambulance arrived at 2:08 p.m. Felix had sustained 12 broken ribs, a fractured pelvis, a broken left hip, foot and femur, both lungs collapsed, both kidneys and spleen ruptured, and three bullet wounds to the arm, mouth and head. He was admitted to Paddington Hospital, but died at 2:42 p.m. 3 minutes later, having detected a very faint pulse, Barbara was admitted to Paddington Hospital. She was given blood, plasma, and began to show signs of recovery. But by the time her fiancé Thomas had arrived, it was too late. At 8:40 p.m, Barbara Shuttleworth died, with her mother at her side. Next to his bed, Felix had left his last will and testament. In it, he left almost everything to his ex-wife Maria, his gold ring, his watch, his locket, his medallion, his bank balance, totaling almost £67,000, which was to be used for the education of their son, and the deeds to their home in Zakopane, which he had legally signed over to Maria, ironically, on the day that Barbara had got engaged. In a letter to his son Andrea, he wrote,
"My son, please excuse me for the things which have happened, but my life is broken. I don't blame anybody, and I myself am not to be blamed. Be a good man and take me as an example until my 50th year of age. Afterwards, I was a weak man. She is a bad woman, Barbara. She influenced me to my divorce, proceedings of which, although happy, I did not start. She is very bad, but I love her. Therefore, I take her with me. Pray for my poor soul. Your father, F. Sturber."
An inquest was held at Westminster's Coroner's Court on the 6th of August 1948. And with the jury not even needing to retire to consider their verdict, it was declared that Felix Sturber had murdered Barbara Shuttleworth and then committed suicide whilst the balance of his mind was disturbed. Barbara Shuttleworth was 26 years old. She was a lovely girl, with a good job, a happy family, and a bright future, whose radiant smile illuminated rooms, whose charm made people truly love her, and whose warmth and passion for others led a really beautiful person to lose her life far too early. She was due to marry Thomas Lupton a few days later, but instead, she was buried. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. Don't forget, Extra Mile is next, so pop your tea on the hob, a cake in your gob, as it's time to chow down and witter about nonsense. Before that, a thank you to my new Patreon supporter, who this week is Mary McCrae. I thank you. As well as a thank you to all Patreon supporters, whether old or new, previous or impending, as well as everyone who leaves reviews, comments, and shares this podcast with their friends. To everyone, I thank you. Murder Mile was researched, written, and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult with No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Oh, dear Lord. Oh. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Extra Mile. Sorry, that was really difficult. I was trying to do Felix Sturber's voice for that end bit, and it keeps going into bloody Welsh all the time. It keeps going, I can't even do Welsh now. Now my brain can't, I can't concentrate now. I'm working out. My brain kept going, hello, like that. It kept going all Swansea, and I kept shouting at myself, stop being bloody Welsh, but it wouldn't stop. So I think I'm going to try. We've had 4 weeks of Eastern and Southern European accents, and it's killing me. Last three episodes, I had three accents I had to do. This one, another one. I think I'm just going to do some. Get some good old Cockney accents in there. Anyone who's murdered, who doesn't happen to be from the United Kingdom, can piss off. I'm only going to do, from this point onwards, I'm just going to say, right, they've all got Cockney accents. It's so difficult to do. It really hurt my throat. My voice is killing. Anyway, Extra Mile time. Here we are, Extra Mile time. This is the extra bit, the bollocksy bit afterwards, which takes no effort. I just sit here and waffle for about 45 minutes and everyone goes, oh, I love it, because you make a cup of tea and you have a cake and you talk shit. The irony is, this is a good point, the irony is, if Murder Mile at the start wasn't as contained as it was, you can hear Coot outside. He's been at that all bloody morning. If the first part of Murder Mile isn't as scripted and contained as and tight as it was, this bit wouldn't work because no one would come to this. If I just did these every week, no one would come to it. It'd be the lowest ranking podcast out there. Because think about it, there's loads of this kind of shit out there where someone thinks that what they have to say is important and it's not. It's just shit. It's bollocks. But it works because I think someone said it on a tour to me recently. They said, "Oh, I love Extra Mile," and I was like, "Oh, God, not another one," because it's quite I'll be honest, it's a little bit depressing when you work hard on the first bit and everyone loves the bit which takes no fucking effort. But actually, she made a good point. She said the reason why it works is that the first bit is like kind of like a nice meal. It's your starter and your main course, and it's a really nice meal and you're really enjoying the meal. But after you've had the meal, you want to have a nice dessert, you want to have an ice cream, you want to have a palate cleanser, and that's what it is. It's the first part so contained, the second part is free and different, and that's why it works. And then I was like, it all makes sense now. That makes sense. So so this is Extra Mile, the palate cleanser, the glass of water at the end of the meal, or you know, it's not a dessert wine, because as we all know, dessert wines are expensive, but they taste horrible as well. I would say it's a nice cup of tea, or a nice cold beer, or like an icy smoothie or something like that. Or just a nice beer would be nice. Oh, anyway, right. I need to make a cup of tea, and I'm going to open some windows and doors because I need some fresh air because it's hot. Well, it's not hot, but. Oh, look, not just a coot, a moorhen. The little moorhen are outside. But the ones around here are a little bit nervous, a little bit nervy. And a bit needy as well. So I'm just making myself a nice tea, a nice cup of tea. Yep, having a fight. The coot is having a shout at the moorhen. They don't seem to fight, they just seem to shout at each other and go, and they're a bit stupid as well. Because they I'll throw them some bread. You can't give bread to coots. I know people say you can't give bread to wildlife, but actually the RSP good to do that. My laptop just switched off. I think. Hang on. No, you're still running. The RSPB did say with swans as well. They say It's okay for them. They can have that, and they actually use it as part of their kind of winter diet as well. So, but I give very, very soft bread to them. But if you throw out some bread to the coots, instead of going, right, there's lots of bread here, so I'll have the big one, the little ones can kind of bugger off. What they'll do is they'll go, no, I'll spend 10 minutes chasing people away from all the bread. And by the time they come back, the bread's gone because the seagulls have gotten. They're really stupid. Really stupid. Right. Oh, I forgot to put my tea bag in. I was so busy talking about tea bags and so busy talking about coots. Tea bag, milk and sugar. See, if you're new to Extra Mile, it's really. See, it is waffle, isn't it? It is absolute waffle. Absolute twaddle. But there we go. The cake of the day today. Oh, yes. Although, as we all know, there's not many cake. I was in. Oh, we'll get to that shortly. I'm having a vanilla cream crown. Oh, it's like a soft pastry with a vanilla cream in the centre with almonds on top and some icing. Oh, yeah, that's going to go down a treat. Right, before we start and get into waffling, let's do some questions before the kettle boils. Right, 10 questions coming up. They start easy, they get harder. So, you get the answers at the end of Extra Mile. So, here we go. Question one. What was Barbara's middle name? Question two. What was Felix's middle name? Question three. What was the nearest tube station to Barbara's home? And also, actually, Felix's home as well. Question four. What was Barbara wearing that day? Question five. What floor did Felix jump from? I've got some pictures online. So if you're a Patreon supporter, there'll be some extra pictures on there. But I'll post them on my blog as well, so you can have a look and see what the location looks like. Question six. What three countries did Felix escape through having fled from Poland? So when he left Poland, where did he? What three countries did he escape to? He went through three. Question seven. Where did Felix and Barbara first meet? Were you listening? Question eight. Rookie pilots during World War II are said to have only had a lifespan of how long? Question nine. Barbara's great-grandfather was what? I can give you some more information on that very shortly. And question 10. Now, this wasn't mentioned in the episode, but which other airman who may or may not have been trained by Felix as an airman was stationed in Regent's Park and often ate at the Lion's Corner House Tea Room in Marble Arch? Now, if you've listened to all the other series, you will know that answer. Ooh, right. Kettle's still brewing. So, hope you're all well. I know that there's all the coronavirus bullshit going on at the moment. If like me, you're self-employed, I hope all is going well. All of my things are so. The murder mile walks, I'm having to start cancelling all those. People aren't booking in, rightly so. I'm having to start giving refunds. Gonna have to shut down for a couple of weeks. That's that. The live tour, the live show is probably going to be binned as well. Although the people who are the promoters haven't actually told me anything yet, so I'd actually know whether we're doing it or not. So that's not happening. The new live, the new tour that I'd mentioned last week, that's been pulled. So I'll do that over summer sometime. But yeah, it doesn't make sense to do it right now. Everything's pretty much shut down. So for all the self-employed people out there, good luck. Hunker down, because obviously, you know, if you're lucky enough to be in a full job where your employer's going, oh, it's fine, you know, you'll self-isolate for a couple of weeks and I'll pay you full pay or half pay. For those of you who earn basically hand to mouth, Jesus. So luckily I've still got the podcast to do. That will hopefully that will just Just going to let it brew for a bit. Hopefully that will get some money coming in, and hopefully there'll be some sponsorship. But I deliberately haven't been putting money away into a secret account. I've let it sit there, so I've got enough money to last, I think. But yeah, oh God, it's all up in the air, isn't it? I was in the big Tesco's yesterday having a little mooch around. Thought I'd pick up some stuff because it was Sunday. I'd written the final part of this and done a rewrite on it, and then I was like, right, because I hadn't got a tour yesterday because I had to cancel that one. I was like, right, I'm going to do a long bike ride and film some of the locations. So I filmed this location over in Queensway, but then I had to go down to Richmond to film the locations for episode 87, which is coming up. There's another location in Shepherd's Bush. So I did a nice... If you go on my YouTube channel, I did another Reg Christie one that I went past. So I put that one on there. But that was like a 30-35 minute bike ride. I was absolutely knackered by the time I got back. But then I was heading back. I went into Tesco's and thought, I'll pick up some nice stuff. I'll pick up like some burgers or stuff, because I like to treat myself on a Sunday. Tesco's, Jesus, it was like Russia in the 1980s. There was nothing there. Massive Tesco's, and everyone had panicked. Everyone was like, oh, panic, I need to buy waffles. And it's like, come on, guys, you don't need to panic. The only reason you're panicking is because everyone else is panicking. You think you have to panic as well. But don't. Let's not forget, people, that if you're fit and healthy and you're kind of an average age, you're pretty much going to be all right. It's the older generation and the younger generation. Now, the younger generation are lucky, like, you have babies and kids. They've got their parents to look after them. But let's not forget, older generation, many are probably living by themselves. They don't have cars. They probably don't have cars. They can't go out to all these supermarkets and fill up with like 100 toilet rolls and all of the rice that they need and all the coffee. They'll have a little shopping basket. So they're basically going out every day. And there's nothing there that they can buy because people have gone out and bought loads and flogging it off on eBay. So, you know. Chill out, everyone. Chill out. We're all going to get through this. It's all going to be fine. It's all going to be fine, isn't it? It's just the thing that everyone feels that they have to panic. They see other people panicking. They have to panic as well. There's really no need. It's just, if everyone just chill the F out, we're all going to be fine. Right. Everyone's self-isolating, but what I've realised is I self-isolate all the time. As a podcaster, I spend probably 12 hours a day sitting here in the boat by myself, writing or recording or editing, not seeing anyone, not talking to anyone. So, you know, self-isolating for me is basically just a regular day. I think the only difference that's going to be is either a regular amount of cake or less cake. That's really going to be it. But I've got tea to last. Well, I always have enough tea to last about a year anyway. I always have enough rice to last a year. I always have enough toilet paper to last a year. It's like, you know, I'm one of these. I've got enough petrol. I've got enough. Yeah, I've got enough of everything. I store stuff. So always have done, because I don't like knowing that I might run out. So I always store a lot of stuff. But yeah, we're all going to be fine. I think who was it, the Independent said this? They said that more people will probably end up bankrupt than will die of coronavirus. And I think I was like, yeah, you're absolutely right, because everyone's panicking. Panic buying, but also panic not buying. And therefore a lot of businesses are shutting and going under. So actually it's not the fact that you will die from the virus, it's the fact that your finances will go a bit kasplooey, but that's it. Anyway, fuck that. It's all bollocks. Right. Let's do some extra stuff. There's some stuff in this episode that I probably didn't get to put all the way in, so let's do it. The letter that Felix left to his son, I'll read it. I won't do the voice because I really struggle with that. But I edited it down for the episode, but this is what it said. It said, it was in Polish, but this is it translated. It says, Dear Andrew, but that's the English translation of Andrea. Dear Andrew, please excuse me for the things which happened, but my life is broken. Therefore, I decided to settle things in the most simple manner. It happened. I don't blame anybody, and I myself am not to be blamed. Bit modest there. It is the unhappy sunk consequences of circumstances. Be a good man and take me as an example until my 50th year of age. Afterwards, I was a weak man and broken through hard fate. I bless mother, grandmother, grandfather and my sisters. They should forgive my act. She is a bad woman, Barbara. She influenced me to my divorce, proceedings of which, happily though, I did not start. That is what it seems to me now. My life is broken. She is very bad, but I love her. Therefore, I take her with me. Pray for my poor soul. Your father, F. Sturber. There you go. Lovely. Now, I didn't put this in the episode because I couldn't work out a place to put it. But there was a letter on his bedside table addressed to Barbara, which was unopened. Now, it was undated as well, but we know that he wrote it the night before the murder because it gives reference. He was expecting a call from her. She didn't call. He went to her place, as always, and stood underneath her window at 35 Bark Place. And he said that she made some kind of gesture that he didn't like. Something to do with her neck, he said. I might have edited it. I don't think I have the full version. But it says, "What gestures did you show yesterday to me at 10:30 p.m. from your window?" In the original version, he said, "neck out." It was kind of like neck out, head forwards, but it didn't really explain it well. "Frank answer, please. Why didn't ring in?" This is his words. "Why didn't ring in and what me why to ring?" Yeah. "Do you love me still or is all over now? You are in love with me or you are in love with somebody else. Do you reckon that you have broken my love? I lost nearly 6 years for you." I think I put this in the episode. "I sent for divorce in Poland. It's your bad deed. Do you believe in God? If so, say your prayers. We will die together. You have broken my life. I will break yours and mine too. F. Sturber." He loves signing it off F. Sturber. Yeah, I put some of that in the episode, but I didn't put the early bit about the gestures because that kind of really threw me off. Oh dear, I got burpees. One of the things I didn't put in was that it was a lot of people going on in and around the scene when the murder happened. Mrs. Beatrice Bentham, she was the cleaner. She'd been there for about she'd been cleaning the flat for about 2 years. Not it had taken her 2 years to clean it. She was a cleaner in the flat for 2 years. Otherwise, she was a shit cleaner. She'd been there about 25, 30 minutes. She saw no one else in the flat. She went through. She was cleaning the kitchen. There was a lady with her called Mrs. Beavis who was helping her out. I didn't put her in the episode because she doesn't need to be there. It doesn't serve a purpose. About 1:55 p.m., she said she heard three shots, then a pause, a thud, and then another shot. But in a later statement, she said she heard two extra shots. She came to Felix's room, couldn't get in because the door was locked. She called out, "Mr. Porter, Charles Haddon, was coming down the steps. He was on the roof, don't forget. He was having a bit of a cheeky cigarette and talking to the electricians who were on the roof. He shouted, I can't come in. There's a man gone off the roof." Beatrice and Mrs. Beavis and the porter went down to the ground. They'd been there for about 10 minutes. So Charles Haddon, yeah, he was on the roof talking to the electricians who were fixing a wireless, and I mentioned this already. He heard a shot from the far end of Ralph Court, saw Mr. Sturber jump from the window. He was just wearing his pajama trousers, jumped off. He kind of like stood on the balcony and then kind of leaned forwards and rolled off. And they went down because they didn't realise anything had happened in the room, because obviously the room was the bedroom was locked by that point. But they realised they couldn't get in. They needed to. So Alfred Baldwin, who was an electrician, he was working on the roof just above fixing the antenna for the wireless radio. He heard the shots in there. No one could get into Felix's bedroom, so he climbed down from the roof into the window, which was open. That was the window that Felix had jumped out of. He climbed through the bedroom window, opened the door so the police could get in, and it was him who discovered that Barbara was lying on the bed and she had been shot multiple times. It was a Yale lock, so it's one of those ones where it closes behind itself. So it hadn't been locked. It had, you know, it would have looked sinister for her if she would she would have said, "Oh, why are you locking the door?" But she hadn't. They'd just closed the door behind them. Yeah, it was a narrow ledge. I can't show you the exact location of where it was because the courtyard is kind of sealed off. It's a private courtyard. But what I've done online is I've posted some pictures of, you can see the window itself, and I've posted another window which is identical to it, so you can see what the window ledge looked like as well. So that's all there. What else did we get? Oh yeah, when they got there, so they saw that Barbara still had, she was lying on the bed, but she still had a faint pulse. So they tried their best to revive her, but there was nothing left of her, unfortunately. She arrived at 2:45 p.m. at Paddington Hospital, which is not too far away. Paddington Hospital is where Sir Bernard Spilsbury, the Home Office pathologist, trained. Paddington Hospital is also known as St Mary's. She died at 8:40. Excessive bleeding, hemorrhaging, bleeding from the right ear. They gave her plasma and blood, but she was very weak. She, after about 2 or 3 hours, she started to recover, but then she relapsed and died. Her death was caused by laceration to the brain by a bullet wound. If she would have survived, I mean, who knows how much of her would survive with her injuries to her brain. Felix was admitted at 2:27, so just yes, 2:27. Hit a bullet, two bullet wounds to the inside of his mouth, and inside his mouth they found two flattened, sorry, inside the underside of the skin to his right scalp, they found two flattened bullets. So basically the bullets had gone into his, he'd put the gun in his mouth, he'd fired the shots. They'd gone through his palate, they'd gone through part of his head but not his brain, but they weren't strong enough to go through the skull itself, so they actually embedded on the inside of his scalp. So there was obviously it was fractured there and there was blood up the walls, but you know, they hadn't gone through it, but the energy had. He got an injury to the top of his left arm, where, remember, he tried to shoot himself in the heart but he missed. There was an entrance and exit wound there, and obviously he had multiple injuries, so he actually died of it was mostly of blood loss and shock, just because of all these he'd broken his pelvis. I mean, that's a big injury in its own right, and you can die of multiple blood loss from that. What else we got? Post-mortem, yeah, I kind of covered all that in there. Barbara basically drowned in her own blood because her body cavity was filling up with blood. There was about 3 pints of blood in her chest, which is a lot. What else we got? I think that's it. I pretty much covered everything on this episode. I put in as much as I can. It feels like a long episode. It'll probably be about 35 minutes long. Whew, dear. Oh, my tea! I was waffling and I forgot about my tea. Parched. So parched. Oh, a cup of tea. Oh, it's good. Oh, thank you to the makers of tea. Oh, best invention in the world. As well as the makers of cake. Cake and tea. What more can you ask for? Right. Oh, how long was that? Right, I'm going to do some. I'll do the answers to the questions. God, I'm really knackered. Trying to do Felix's voice really killed me. Right, let's do. Let's have a swig of tea. Yummy. Look at that vanilla crown. It looks lovely. Right, 10 questions. Here's the answers to them. Question number one: what was Barbara's middle name? Her middle name was Sylvia. Question number two, what was Felix's middle name? His middle name was Jan. Question number three, what was the nearest tube station to Barbara's home and Felix's home? Answer, Bayswater. Bayswater is literally just by between Hyde Park and between Hyde Park and Paddington and Notting Hill. So we'll be back in that area again soon. Question four. What was Barbara wearing that day? She was wearing a blue and white cotton dress, a black hat and black shoes. Question five. What floor did Felix jump from? You can have two answers for that. Either is as good. Seventh floor or top floor? Question six. What three countries did Felix escape from? I've really written this question badly. What three countries did Felix escape? Did he go through after he had escaped Poland? Does that make sense? I think I read it better before. Anyway, after he'd escaped Poland, first he went to Romania, then he went to France, then he went to England. Question seven. Where did Felix and Barbara first meet? The answer is the Lion's Corner House Tea Room in Marble Arch. That will come up again shortly. Question number eight. Rookie pilots during World War II were said to have had a lifespan of how long? The answer is 16 minutes. Quite a few rookie pilots during World War II were known as the 16-minuters because obviously there was a lot of turnover of pilots. There was a lot of aircraft being crashed or shot down. And because they really didn't have enough time to train pilots properly, you know, to be a good pilot, you need like a couple of good 100 hours of pilot training, but they just didn't have that. They hadn't got the time to train them. So literally it was like, this is what you do, this is how you fly it, go up. And they literally would go up and either crash it or be shot down because they didn't know how to dogfight. It's like driving a car. Do you know, you see someone get in a car and driving around, like in their first year of driving around, they're like hunched forwards and staring, and like every step is tentative. So yeah, unfortunately, most new pilots did not last very long. And also, you know, it, some things like the Spitfires were like really well built. But, you know, especially with if you look at the Messerschmitts as well, like in the early days of the of World War II, especially with the German aircraft, they were really, really well built at the start. They were actually slightly over-engineered. But the further they got through the war, and with Britain as well, because materials were of short supply, they couldn't use the best materials. So actually you started getting really shonky pieces of work. So things flying in the air that really shouldn't have flown. So question number nine. Barbara's great-grandfather was what? What did he do as a job? It was snuck in there right at the start. His name was Sir Roland Baron on her mother's side. He was a pioneer in the manufacture of ready-to-wear clothing. So this was actually a company called John Baron & Son that was set up in around the 1850s, 1860s. It was a kind of a big factory, and they started doing... instead of like in the old days where it was all kind of like everything was tailored or made by, you know, for each person, it was kind of, they worked out there was a way of making a process where you could just mass produce clothes. And it was so revolutionary, especially post-World War II, that around the time that Barbara was born, the factory was actually visited by King George V. That's how important it was, who came to inspect it and say, oh, well done. It was really big and huge and very important. Whew. Question number 10. Now, I didn't mention this in the episode, but which other airman who may or may not have been trained by Felix Sturber as a trainee airman was stationed at the Regent's Park Barracks and often ate at the Lion's Corner House Tea Room in Marble Arch? Did you guess that one? I've put it as question 10, but I think it should be question 1 because it's quite easy. That, of course, was the Blackout Ripper. Now, obviously, we can't check those details because it's military records. We can't check who was trained as a pilot there, by who. But Felix was training pilots at Regent's Park. The Blackout Ripper, Gordon Cummings, was a trainee airman at Regent's Park around the time that Felix was there. And we know that he definitely ate at the Lion's Corner House Tea Room in Marble Arch because that is where he met his first victim, Evelyn Hamilton, the pharmacist. So whether they knew each other is it's probably unlikely, but they may have crossed paths at some point, so that could be quite interesting. So there we go. Whew, right, that was that. Cool, that was a long record. I'm tired now. I need to have a sleep, but I'm not going to have a sleep because I've got to record this and then I'm going to start writing the new episode and then I need to cancel all the Murder Miles. All the Murder Mile walks, not the podcasts. That's that. That's the end of this episode. I've got tea. I've got a cake. I'm going to go and do some work. I'm going to power through. I'm knackered. That 35 mile cycle ride yesterday really killed me. Anyway, right, onwards and upwards. That was that. Hope you enjoyed that episode. I thought it was quite an interesting one. Next week, another single part episode, and then some more and some more. They're all different across this series. And then there's some interesting things to go in the middle of the series as well. Some new kind of ideas. But either way, hopefully, unless something horrible happens, all will be well and you'll have an episode every single week. Anyway, that's it. That's me done. Lots of love. Speak to you all soon. Be good. Stay safe. Be healthy. Okay, bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.